This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm meeting all ambassadors whose countries are represented here. And I would like to propose to them that together we initiate a form of outreach to communities, both South African as well as non-South Africans, and begin to become bridge builders.
That South African Minister of International Relations, Naledi Pandor, on efforts to end the recent xenophobic clashes in the country. Also, South Sudan President Salva Kiir and his former First Vice President Riek Machar met in Juba today. Sudan's new cabinet was sworn in yesterday, and an estimated 100,000 people attended mass in Mauritius today as Pope Francis wraps up a three-day visit to Africa. We'll have these stories and more. Stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. There's been more xenophobic violence in South Africa's biggest city, Johannesburg, this weekend, with ethnic Zulu hostile dwellers demanding that foreigners leave the country. The protesters, armed with a variety of weapons, beat people up, looted stores, and smashed vehicles. Police confirmed that one person had been killed, but did not say what nationality the victim was. Attacks mostly launched against foreigners and foreign-owned businesses started in South Africa last week, and the death toll is now 11, with scores injured and many arrested. Darren Taylor reports.
Zulu elder Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi speaks to a large crowd in a park in central Johannesburg. His audience is mostly Zulu men who live in hostels in and around the city. The police say some of them have led in the xenophobic violence. Buthelezi appeals to them to stop attacking foreigners, but the men jeer him. The men scream that foreigners are stealing their jobs. Buthelezi continues, saying he understands the tensions, complaints, and anger, but that those who assault their fellow Africans are turning South Africa into a pariah state. Members of the crowd, some who appear to be drunk, are carrying knives, wooden clubs, and other weapons. They sing, "Foreigners, go back home. Go back to where you come from." Groups then leave the park to march through the city. One leader describes it as a protest against Nigerian drug sellers who are turning our girls into prostitutes. But it soon turns into another spree of looting and smashing store windows and vehicles, with the police shooting rubber bullets at the perpetrators. A band of men storms a building they say has been stolen by foreigners. Residents in the floors above pelt the attackers with bricks and other objects. The police fire stun grenades to try to quell the chaos. On national television Monday, Minister of International Relations Naledi Pandor appealed to South Africans to remember who they are.
A people who should love peace, who respect humanity, and who believe in the rights of all. We need to call on all our people to really end this violence. But we do assert that there is a strong element of criminality here. The levels of destruction, the theft that constantly accompanies these incidents, suggests that there's a planned set of criminal actions.
Pandor says the South African police will pursue people who exploit ill feeling against foreigners for criminal purposes. Equally, she adds, law enforcement agencies will probe claims that foreign migrants are involved in crimes such as drug dealing. The minister acknowledges that perhaps her government hasn't done enough to improve relations between South Africans and foreigners.
I'm meeting all ambassadors whose countries are represented here. And I would like to propose to them that together we initiate a form of outreach to communities, both South African as well as non-South Africans, and begin to become bridge builders.
But at this stage, the voices of those intent on burning the bridges remain the loudest, with Zulu agitators demanding that government announce a plan to deal with illegal immigrants. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Now to South Sudan, where President Salva Kiir and his former first vice president Riek Machar met in Juba today ahead of the country's November 12th deadline to form a unity government. The chalks are injecting new energy into the peace agreement process, but observers say officials run the risk of missing another critical target. Kiir's itinerary included meetings with Machar and a Sudanese delegation. The earlier deadline of May 12th to form a transitional government of national unity was missed after the parties failed to meet critical benchmarks, including security arrangements, the unification of forces, and the number of states and their boundaries. Leading experts say it is unlikely the parties will be ready to form the unity government by November 12th, while others say certain critical stipulations could be completed relatively quickly. In late July, the U.S., Britain, and Norway blamed the slow peace process implementation on a lack of momentum. However, the renewed talks between the two leaders appear to have the peace process moving in a positive direction. Well, Sudan's new cabinet was sworn in yesterday, 5 months after the military ousted longtime President Omar al-Bashir. Can the new ministers win acceptance and guide Sudan to elections in 2022? Well, Naba Mohideen has reaction from Khartoum.
The new cabinet was set up under a power-sharing agreement between the military rulers who ousted Bashir and pro-democracy protest leaders. Political analyst Mohammed Abdurrahman thinks the new cabinet is winning wide acceptance in Sudan and that the minister should use this acceptance to build a strong representative government. The post-al-Bashir era has witnessed many changes. The situation could get complicated and reach a peak that could lead to a serious turn, Abdurrahman says. Sudan could pass this dark tunnel by the new cabinet sworn in, which had the widest public acceptance since Sudan independence. The new government should work on the comprehensive reconciliation and the social development, he adds. Democracy supporters like Fifian Youssef celebrated the formation of the cabinet Monday. Youssef expressed confidence in the choices by Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. She says forming the cabinet is a very progressive step towards democracy, even if it was affected by political shares and interventions. But Hamdok is an expert and economist, and the cabinet names he chose are qualified and experts. Youssef hopes to see the international and regional support for the new cabinet and the lifting of imposed sanctions by the U.S., as long as the cabinet is a civilian government. The cabinet has 4 women among the 18 ministers in the positions of foreign affairs, higher education, youth and sports, and social welfare. Protesters like Sausan Misbah see this as a good sign. Misbah says as a woman who participated in the uprising, she thinks women representation in the new government is very good, as they were part of the change in Sudan. Misbah thinks that women will be part of the upcoming change and it will be a fundamental one. Like every step of Sudan's 2019 revolution, formation of the cabinet was preceded by weeks of negotiations and delays. The next step is creation of a legislative body with 300 members due to be set up within the next 3 months. Meanwhile, the trial of former President Bashir on corruption charges has been postponed to next week as his defense seeks to have his past confessions thrown out of court. Naba Mohideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
The In the week since military and civilian leaders in Sudan signed a landmark power-sharing agreement, heavy rains have caused the Nile to flood, damaging tens of thousands of homes. The pact calls for a three-year transitional period, leading to elections for a civilian government. Although the political instability has created extra problems, many victims say the revolution has strengthened their sense of community. In Khartoum, Isha Sharai and Naba Mohideen have more.
As political negotiations continue in Khartoum on the formation of a new government, thousands of houses were swamped by waters from the Nile. Abdu Al-Azam Majid, a resident of Al-Azuzab, just south of the capital, says his entire house is underwater. Majid says that at its worst, the water reached his waist, and that some of his neighbors were in even worse shape. Fuel shortages, one of the causes of the protests which toppled former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, have increased the challenge of draining flooded areas, as most pumps require fuel. While the one pump functioning in Al-Azuzab drains water out of the town, residents and volunteers fill sandbags in an attempt to reinforce a cracked barrier that, in previous years, had kept Nile waters out of their homes. As Sudan's new government is still forming, local aid organizations are unsure how and when state aid will be made available, said Hassan Mustafa, a volunteer at Nafir. Mustafa says floods affect residents near the Nile all around the country every year because of a lack of infrastructure, and adds that political turmoil over the last year, as well as the fact that the government has not yet fully been formed, has slowed the recovery process this year. Nafir, which means collective or community aid, is made up of volunteers who assess damages, collect water and medicine, and sometimes help evacuate victims out of affected areas. Though Nafir was created a few years ago, some victims, like Mohamed Salah, say that as the country waits for its legislative body to be formed in the wake of months of protests, the general sense of community in the country has increased. Salah says that the political change has resulted in social change. He notes that the youth who opposed the government have also in some ways replaced them, stepping up to help flood victims and deliver aid. He says the youth have done great work in this chapter of Sudan's history. The rains have eased, and the floods in some areas are beginning to recede. Many Sudanese hope the country's political crisis will do the same. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Khartoum.
Past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. An estimated 100,000 people attended Mass in Mauritius today as Pope Francis wrapped up a three-country visit to Africa with warnings about the struggles of the young and economic models that sacrifice people and the environment on the altar of speculation and profit. It was the first papal visit in 30 years to the idyllic island that is among the continent's most stable and prosperous countries. It gained independence in 1968. The Pope said the young are suffering the most from the country's economic growth, including unemployment, uncertainty about the future, and a growing drug problem that he called a new slavery. Francis earlier visited Mozambique and Madagascar. Well, the Nigeria Hydrological Services Agency says the country will experience torrential downpours and massive flooding this month. The warning is stirring alarm. Flooding from rains in August has already ravaged hundreds of communities. Chika Adua reports from the southern city of Enugu.
Nigeria is approaching the peak of its rainy season, and flooding is expected to hit 15 out of 36 states this month. The Hydrological Services Agency has issued a red alert because of above normal water levels on the country's two largest rivers, the Benue and the Niger. In August, many communities along the rivers were cut off due to collapsed bridges and impassable roads. Four students were killed when a pedestrian bridge fell at a university in the northern region. With thousands of houses, hectares of farmland and produce destroyed, along with schools and shops, the economic impact of this year's flooding is expected to be high, and the country's emergency management agency is stepping in to distribute items like cement bags, blankets, and hygiene products. Peter Ojugo, a professor of geography at Nigeria's University of Benin, works with the Nigerian Meteorological Society. He has been tracking the extreme weather patterns and says the government has repeatedly failed to take preemptive measures to reduce the impact of flooding.
What they prefer doing, or what they are doing now, is more of services after the impact rather than preventing the occurrence.
Ojugo suggests that silt be removed from the rivers to increase the volume of water they can hold. He also recommends that town planners enforce regulation on where buildings are constructed, saying this is a glaring weak spot across the country. City regulators look out for buildings being constructed near waterways. Such buildings are often marked with an X, designating an order to stop construction work. Stella Ojeme, the Director for Information in the Federal Capital Territory Administration, explains that even in the nation's capital of Abuja, enforcing building codes is a challenge.
Most of our people will go buy white paint, paint over the stop work mark. First of all, you find people who go and build where they shouldn't build. You find people who build on floodplains. And you find some people who dump their refuse in gutter.
Ojugo says climate change is making a real impact in Nigeria, but the government has not made the issue a priority. Additionally, the Nigerian Hydrological Services Agency says its weather data collection equipment is being vandalized and stolen. Clement Eze, the agency's director general, spoke at a workshop last month asking the public to help stop this trend. He said it is having an impact on the agency's ability to forecast extreme weather.
We can no longer take readings. Maybe it may take about a week or two, or if there are no resources, it may even take more than 6 months before we can go back and replenish or, you know, repair. And again, these equipment are imported from outside Nigeria.
During Nigeria's worst flooding in 2012, the Niger River reached a record high level of 12.84 meters. 2 million Nigerians were forced from their homes and 363 people were killed, according to the National Emergency Management Agency. Chika Odua for VOA News, Enugu, Nigeria.
Well, Africa's three richest men have more wealth than the poorest 650 million people across the continent, according to a new Oxfam report. Delegates to the Commonwealth Association of Polytechnics in Africa say the key toward shared development is promoting technical and vocational education and training skills. Eugene Uwimana has details from Kigali.
The report is called A Tale of Two Continents and shows that Africa is rapidly becoming the global epicenter of extreme poverty. While the number of people living on less than $1.90 a day has plummeted, in Asia, the number in Africa is rising. The World Bank estimates that 87% of the world's extreme poor will be in Africa by 2030 if current trends continue. Experts and leaders on the continent say the solution may be to equip youth with technical and vocational education and training TVT skills. This is confirmed by the youth who are in workshops in different corners of the country. 23-year-old Nzaisenga Pascal is a welder in Gwanda. He joined the Ruhuha Vocational Education and Training Center when he was in the third year of secondary school. He says, I wouldn't be working if I have not joined technical and vocational education. He says many who were his classmates are jobless. They are very poor, but this career feeds me and my entire family, he says. However, Pascal's courage and hope shrink when he thinks of his materials, which he calls insufficient. Says materials are very expensive. To have mine, it requires at least 300,000 Gwandan francs. These are not mine. I work for someone. I can get $4 a day. According to educators, challenges that youth like Pascal face are due to insufficient investment in TVET schools by African governments. Dr. Edwin Tolno is the principal of Rift Valley Technical Institute in Kenya.
The other problem that has been there is the governments, in various governments in Africa, have not been giving attention to TVET, so that the funding has been skewed towards universities and primary education, so that TVET was left out. So those are some of the issues that we think we need to tackle as government.
Youth who get chances to study technical and practical skills say it is very difficult for them to get jobs because big companies sweep all tenders. Jaufar is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth Association of Polytechnics in Africa, CAPA, says this problem needs to be urgently addressed if Africa wants to raise many billionaires.
We've realized that member institutions, member countries are doing things differently, and they are doing things individually. How do we put together our efforts? How do we share the facilities? How do we share the resources effectively? And how do we address the issue of youth for skill acquisition, but more importantly, for employability?
Wealth for the three richest billionaires in Africa is $28.8 billion. Aliko Dangote, $14.1 billion. Nikki Oppenheimer, $7.7 billion. And Johann Rupert, $7 billion, according to Forbes magazine's 2019 billionaires list. Economic experts warn that if youth are not equipped with vocational education and training skills to fund their own jobs in the continent's economy, they will always be struggling. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the biggest threat to President Yoweri Museveni's re-election in 2021 may be a 37-year-old musician. The future of Uganda on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.